And good morning. Welcome to Cool Science Radio. John Wells here with Lynn Ware Peake. We have a couple of really good guests for you this morning. First, we talk with about GMOs, genetically modified organisms. It's a hot topic around the world. We speak with an environmental reporter who travels across the United States to investigate the topic from one of the world's leading nonprofit plant research centers in St. Louis to the papaya fields of Hawaii, to a family farm in the Chesapeake Bay that grows grapes and tomatoes for local vegetables alongside GMO corn and soybeans. Well, we're going to try to get to the bottom of this GMO debate.
Yeah, really interesting. We'll look forward to that conversation. Then we speak about the concept of time with an award-winning staff writer from the New Yorker magazine. It's Alan Burdick. Now, he's written a fantastic account of time from when it was first talked about some 3,000 years ago to our present preoccupation with just not having enough of it, how we have changed time and how time has changed us. Stay with us for that conversation.
These two guests, when we return, you're listening to Cool Science Radio, KPCW in Park City. We'll be right back.
I'm Beth Lohman from Park City Mountain and supporter of KPCW. Park City Mountain's Epic Promise grants and donations focus on youth programs and environmental initiatives that impact our local communities. Grants fund programs that are designed to help kids achieve in the classroom and develop an interest for the outdoors by engaging guests, local communities, and our employees. Information at epicpromise.com.
This is Dr. Phil Davidson of Davidson Orthopedics, KPCW's supporter, providing personalized knee and shoulder care, focusing on cartilage restoration and joint resurfacing, and now incorporating stem cell therapy. More information on our website at davidsonorthopedics.com.
And welcome back to Cool Science Radio. In the past two decades, GMOs have come to dominate the American diet. Advocates hail them as the future of food, an enhanced method of crop breeding that can help feed an ever-increasing global population and adapt to a rapidly changing environment. Critics on the other side, well, they're calling for their banishment, insisting GMOs were designed by overeager scientists and greedy corporations to bolster an industrial food system that forces us to rely on cheap, unhealthy processed food so they can turn an easy profit. In response, health-conscious brands such as Trader Joe's and Whole Foods have started boasting that they are GMO-free, and companies like Monsanto have become the villains in the eyes of the average consumers. Our guest, McKay Jenkins, is an environmental writer who has traveled the country in his quest to get to the bottom of this topic. McKay Jenkins, welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
Yeah, very much enjoyed your book. It's a very balanced reading on the topic, and I learned a lot. Help us all understand this. You get both sides screaming at each other. You get the pro-GMOs saying they have science on their side. You've got the other people saying that this stuff is not right, and at the same time, interestingly, you have this marketing push as people say that they don't want to have GMO foods. Companies are coming out and proudly stating that they don't have GMO foods anymore. But then someone like McDonald's is bragging that they don't have GMO potatoes, and yet all of their fountain drinks are corn syrup, and all of their beef is from cattle that eat GMO grains. Help us understand this sea of madness.
That's an excellent term for it. Yeah, so it took me several years to get to the bottom of all this because, as you say, there's so much noise out there on this topic. There's screaming on both sides. I'm not even sure there are two sides. I think there are many sides, but everybody's very loud, and not everybody actually has a handle on the story. So, you know, when companies say that science has proven that GMOs are safe, they are, in the very tiniest and most literal sense, true. I mean, that every major science organization has said that eating a genetically altered plant is not a dangerous thing, no more dangerous than eating a regular plant. But that's a very disingenuous claim, and they don't actually address the much larger questions, which is, what happens when you have 170 million acres of genetically modified corn and soybeans planted across the United States, which, as you say, is used primarily to create processed foods, cheap hamburgers, cheap chicken nuggets, cheap chips, cheap soda, all of which is creating an obesity epidemic, which we're well aware of, all of which requires an enormous volume of synthetic chemicals to fight off bugs, kill weeds, which has all kinds of downstream consequences, the most obvious of which is when you kill every single weed on 170 million acres, one thing you're killing is the milkweed that supplies the only food for monarch butterflies. So the reason the monarch butterflies become kind of a symbol of the anti-GMO crowd is that, you know, monarchs are now at something like 4% of their natural populations. That's a direct consequence of eating the way we do. Now, it's not like GMOs cause that problem, but GMOs are a central part of that problem. So really the question here is, what's the story about industrial food and how do GMOs play into it, and is there a way to disentangle ourselves from all of this?
Right. And I think some people are under the impression that the scientists are there putting together these new strains, these new foods that are going to help the underdeveloped countries and really be able to help this epidemic of all these kids that are starving. And yet you point out in your book that the United States produces all this stuff and only 1% goes to developing countries or underdeveloped countries. Yeah, developing countries, 86% to the developed countries like Europe, Canada, and South Korea, and then 13% is consumed by the United States. So only 1% goes to these countries that are struggling. Is that true?
Right. I mean, yeah, I think that's a really important point. So so what we have here, the basic fact is that, like I said, we have 170 million acres of monocultured GMO crops being used to make cheap, processed, and fast food. Now, that is a problem, and the companies know it's a problem, and the term GMO has gotten kind of a bad taste for most people. They don't really know what they are. They just know they don't want them. So what companies are trying to do is figure out some way to change the story, change the narrative so that people will think more positively about GMOs. One way they can do it is by saying things like, the world is starving and they need our food to feed them. That is not true, right? The world doesn't need more cheap hamburgers or cheap soda. What the world needs is more people paying more attention to local farms under local circumstances so they can grow their own food. We don't want people, I mean, we, the companies do, but the rest of the world doesn't want African farmers and South American farmers depending on American companies to feed people. That is not in the, you know, general interest of sustainable agriculture globally. So every now and then you'll see something pop onto the world stage, like just last week they've just introduced this thing called a GMO apple. The Arctic apple is now for sale in some Midwestern supermarkets. And that's of no consequence. I mean, the apple will or will not be a popular thing, but what the companies are hoping is that people will see that as a very happy, benign example of GMO, and therefore say, look, see, we told you GMOs are fine, so stop hassling us about GMOs. So really, the whole feed the world thing is really it's a magician's trick to make you pay attention to one thing while the main thing is happening off stage, and that is the production of basically unnutritious, high-calorie food for the rest of us.
Mm. McKay, I'm wondering if you could define the difference between a hybrid, for example, and a genetically modified organism. And I'm wondering, I got these beautiful apple pears, a mix between an apple and a pear at Costco last week. They were delicious. And as I was eating them, I thought, okay, am I going against what I fundamentally believe? Is this a GMO product or is this just a hybrid?
That's a really good question. And, you know, you'll get scientists to have both kind of scientific and sort of historical debates about this question. One side will say that human beings taking a genome from one organism and taking a piece of that and sticking it in the genome of another organism is nothing more than the way evolution has always happened. It's just sped up. That's all we're doing is speeding it up. And the other people will say that is entirely ridiculous, that nature would never combine certain kinds of things, like, you know, taking a bacterium and putting it inside a corn plant, or taking a fish gene. I mean, there were some experiments trying to make tomatoes grow more easily in cold climates. You could take a gene out of a fish, a salmon, a cold water fish, put it in a tomato plant to make the tomato grow in colder conditions. Now, nature would never do that. You would never cross a fish and a tomato. So really, this brings up very interesting questions of ethics. It also brings up questions about to what lengths will we go to produce food? And, you know, this brings up these questions of like, how disconnected are we from food? Like, is the ideal way to eat to take some kind of prefab pill and stick it in your mouth and get all your nutrition that way? Like, that would be the simplest, least complicated thing. On the other hand, you know, that disconnects us from very deep ritualistic things about the way we grow food, the way we honor plants and farmers and the landscape and all that other stuff. So, you know, these questions are interesting kind of theoretically, but they're also interesting culturally and almost existentially to think about how we feed ourselves. We're the first couple of generations to not really have any idea where our food is coming from. Like, no one in the history of humanity didn't know where their food came from, but we don't. My students think potatoes grow on trees, you know? It's like, how did we get to this point? That's really what the bigger questions are.
Speaking of tomatoes, you talk in your prologue about square tomatoes. And, you know, you take us back to 1994, which seems very recent. Is that really when the first GMOs were put out on the market for mass consumption?
Yeah, I mean, this what was branded as the Flavor Saver tomato was put out in 94, and it was rumored to be square. It turned out not to be square, but that was the rumor. Really, what it was grown, I mean, the squareness of it and the thick skin of it was actually on the design. It was designed for an industrial distribution system. So they were not creating the best possible tasting tomato. What they were trying to create was the best possible shipping tomato. So this is a very why GMOs are such a part of the global food system, because a lot of these foods are being genetically modified in order to plug them in to a global system that can ship, for example, soybeans across the country or across the world, or in that case, tomatoes across the country. The problem with those tomatoes is they didn't taste good. They may ship well, but nobody was buying them because they tasted terrible. What you want to do if you live in New Jersey is you want to eat tomatoes grown in New Jersey in August. You don't want to eat tomatoes in New Jersey in February that were grown in California or Mexico or Israel or someplace. You want to, you know, support and get used to eating locally and seasonally and all that. That's how we've evolved, to eat the sweet stuff when it's sweet and, you know, the potatoes when it's cold and the squash when it's cold. We've become used to eating anything we want 24/7, 12 months of the year. Doesn't matter where it's grown. We don't care. We just want the watermelon in February, which just makes no sense. I mean, scientists can do that, but that really, it fails on all kinds of other grounds.
I'm glad you brought up tomatoes in New Jersey. When I was a kid, I grew up in New York, and our family vacation every year was to go down to the Jersey Shore. It was in August, and we would stop at these little farm stands on the way to the ocean once you got off the New Jersey Turnpike. And my father used to say, we're going to stop, we're going to get a ton of tomatoes, you're not going to believe how they're going to taste. And they really did taste different. They tasted great. And tomatoes don't taste like that anymore. And I think that there are some genetic scientists here in Utah that have pretty good intentions. They're trying to bring back a good tasting tomato. But what's happened to our tomatoes? They just are void of any taste.
Well, you know something? If you went back to New Jersey in August, you would eat a tomato and you would be over the moon just like you were as a kid. The truth is, you can still get amazing tomatoes in New Jersey, but you only get them in August and September. You don't get them in February. So, you know, I suppose this is an ethical stance, which is, you know, you can't get a really awesome New Jersey tomato in February in Utah. And then the question is, should you be able to do that? Should you be able to demand that we reorganize things so that you can eat a New Jersey tomato anywhere around the country any time of the year? That actually is a very interesting ethical question, and I'm not totally sure that the best answer is yes. You know, maybe the reason those tomatoes tasted so good to you even as a kid is you knew you could only get them for a brief period of time, and then when you got them, you just gorged on them, and that was just a great treat. You know how it is. If you get great stuff all the time, it no longer seems quite so special.
That's right.
And, you know, to say the least, the way you have to manipulate the land in order to grow stuff out of season and out of context can be quite radical, and it has negative consequences.
What has surprised you most as you researched your book?
I have been amazed at how strong most people feel about GMOs and how little information those opinions are based on. So even like highly educated friends of mine who consider themselves foodies, even the foodie crowd, they actually don't know what GMOs are, where they find them. They still think that they're secret Frankenfoods, you know, hiding in the fruit aisle or something. That's not where you find GMOs. Where you find GMOs is in the middle of the supermarket. It's in the fast food. It's in the processed food. It's in the soda. So it's amazing to me how completely ubiquitous these products are, and yet how invisible they are at the same time. That's the great mystery of all this, is you don't see the name Monsanto on a bag of Doritos, and you don't see the name DuPont on a chip box of chicken nuggets or something like that. All this stuff is intimate, and it's everywhere, and the way that this stuff is made is really out of our view. And that's if you're a journalist, that's a very interesting dynamic. That's what drives us to kind of bring stuff up to the light.
Right. If you're just joining us, our guest is McKay Jenkins. He's the author of a new book called Food Fight, GMOs and the Future of the American Diet. So are the Monsantos and the DuPonts of the world, I think one of those companies said, you know, their tagline is something like, "We feed the world," as you have already talked about in this interview. As it turns out, you know, that's not true. But what good have they done? You know, you did so much research. And give us some anecdotes about what you found about big industrial food manufacturing is good.
Well, they've been extremely successful at what they do. I mean, what they have done is really monopolized not just the food production market, but if you think about it, ecologically, they've monopolized the American landscape. So I think I've mentioned this, but in the book, I describe a road trip that my family and I took where we drove from Baltimore all the way to Vancouver. And you drive west from the East Coast, and you basically see nothing but corn and soybeans from Maryland until you get to Colorado. That's what it is. It's dominated the landscape in an absolutely complete way. So in a way, you could say they've been entirely successful at controlling the landscape and controlling food production. And in terms of their business model, that has been a complete success. Now, because they've completely saturated the American landscape and food market, they're starting to expand into other countries. And you're seeing them get a very strong foothold in places like, for example, Paraguay and Argentina and Brazil, where they're starting to push GMO corn and GMO soybeans on farmers down there to start the whole process all over again. And one of the consequences is, of course, deforestation. Like, if you want to grow soybeans, you got to cut down the rainforest to grow them. And if you want to grow corn, you want to graze, you know, feed cattle, like the whole global push to eating more like Americans is actually going to have really negative consequences for, and in addition to other things, climate change, because, of course, this is a very high energy use way of making food. So they've been very successful in their particular business model. The negative consequences for local farmers, local food production, the American diet, genetic diversity, diversity of crops, soil health, water health, all those things are negative consequences. So, you know, they've been successful in one way. The negative things have rippled out in all kinds of unexpected ways as well.
Okay. That surprises me, your answer. I thought you were going to come up with these certain GMOs that have solved something on a world scale, but I just didn't hear that from what, you know, basically
well,
they're
no,
successful.
But let me,
go ahead.
If you'd like, I can address that, and the answer to that is that they're not doing that research. That research is being done, but it's being done by public university researchers. So, you know, whether you're talking about the GMO papaya in Hawaii, or you're talking about, vitamin A-rich golden rice in Asia, or you're talking about golden cassava. This is cassava that has vitamin A in Africa. That research is being done, but it's not being done by these companies because it's not nearly so profitable. That research is being done by public researchers at nonprofit research institutes or at universities. So that is being done. It's just not being done by the companies.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you a question. We're here in Park City, and we just buttoned up our Sundance Film Festival, which ran for 10 days. And one of the films that debuted was a film called Rancher, Farmer, Fisherman, and a fascinating film. And they followed this farmer who started, after tilling his land for so many years and so many generations, to stop tilling his land. And as they were explaining what he was doing, they took a step back from 40,000 feet and they sort of took a look at what other farmers were doing. And there's increasingly a pretty decent percentage of people in the Midwest that are not tilling their land anymore. Are they under pressure from the Monsantos and the DuPonts to stop doing that? And you know, what are your thoughts on all of that?
It's a great question. I mean, I guess the question really is what's the impulse? Are they not tilling to get rid of weeds so that they can spray weed killers? I mean, that would be, you know, it's complicated because not tilling your soil generally helps reduce the runoff. It helps produce soil loss. But it also means that you can be dependent on a lot more herbicides. Another factor, and there's a chapter in the book about this, there's a research institute in Kansas called the Land Institute that is doing even more of what you're talking about, where they're advocating that farmers, instead of growing the same single crop year after year, that you do what's called polyculture, which is to grow multiple crops on the same field, just kind of like the way that Native Americans used to do the Three Sisters, where you have one crop that, like, say, for example, beans that drags nitrogen into the soil, and then a corn crop that grows and benefits from that nitrogen and allows the bean to coil up the corn plant, and a squash that, you know, grows and shades out the weed. So those three things are interdependent, and you get to harvest all three. If you can scale that up, if you can, instead of having 170 million acres of two crops, you could replace a big percentage of that with lots of different kinds of crops. It would provide more genetic diversity, more kinds of food, better protection of the soil, better protection of the water, a lower dependence on irrigation and fossil fuel herbicides. So really, we're talking about people trying to reinvent a system that has become so kind of specialized and monochromatic that it has started to cause all these negative consequences. So that's really, that's a very interesting thing. And farmers are brilliant people. I mean, they're doing cutting-edge things all over the place. The question is, can we do it at a scale that will make a difference in food supply and in environmental protection?
Exactly. Well, again, the book is Food Fight, GMOs and the Future of the American Diet. The author, McKay Jenkins. You may know about McKay from Contamination, which was a fascinating book. McKay, thanks so much for joining us on Cool Science Radio.
Well, thanks for the call. I'm really glad to talk to you.
Thank
okay,
you.
Great. Thank you.
And we'll be right back after these words. We're going to delve into the concept of time, why we don't have enough of it when we return. Stay with us.
This is Steve Roney with Berkshire Hathaway Home Services Utah Properties. We continue to be proud supporters of KPCW, our local source for Park City news. Our agents are Summit and Wasatch County's source for real estate, and we can be reached at bhhsutah.com.
Miller Orthodontics supports KPCW and their involvement with area youth and teens. Speaking of youth, did you know Invisalign has a specific type of aligner just for teens? Over 3/4 of our Invisalign patients are 19 or younger. More information about Invisalign Teen is available at m2ortho.com.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peak, here with John Wells. Time is fleeting. Time drags. Time stands still. Time flies. The concept of time is somewhat enigmatic to those of us who ponder why time passes quickly when you love what you're doing and how it passes slowly when you're bored or unhappy. For me, fourth grade was like a lifetime, while 2016 flew by in the blink of an eye, or so it seemed. Our guest, Alan Burdick, a staff writer and former senior editor at The New Yorker and a National Book Award finalist, as a science and tech writer, he joins us now to talk about the nature of time. Is it science? Is it philosophy? He's written a book, fascinating book, called Why Time Flies, a mostly scientific investigation. Alan Burdick joins us by phone. Welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Hi, great to be here. Thank you for having me.
Well, you know, we were just sitting here talking about how this book, or the concept of time overall, is a hybrid between sort of philosophy and physics, and I think that's what makes it so hard to grasp. Like, where's the point of departure when you when you talk about time?
That's a really good question. I have read, a fair amount, I suppose, as maybe we all have, or as a certain circle of us have, about space-time, and Einstein and relativity. And I studied philosophy in college, and so I've come across a fair amount of philosophy about what time is. That's been discussed for at least 3,000 years. But for the purposes of this book, I really wanted to not engage with really any of that. Because, I feel like maybe you have this experience too. I feel like time is everywhere. It's in everything I do. It's everywhere I look. And just the experience of, waking up in the middle of the night, and it's like, now, kind of coming at me. I wanted to know, what is that about? Where does that come from in my brain? And I really wanted to talk about it in a way in this book that isn't abstract and is not, sort of hard to get a handle on. So I really kind of made a point of, focusing on experiments, talking about my life a little bit and really trying to make it as tangible as possible, because that really is what time is. Time is incredibly tangible.
I love that. So no difficult mathematical formulas in your book.
No, nothing like that.
So, I'd heard this thing some years ago, and I just have always thought it was so curious and funny and ridiculous at the same time. And that is, when you're young, time goes slow. As you get older, time goes very quickly. And this theory was, when you're about 35 years of age, that's when time goes at the rate it's supposed to go. And what's funny about that is you're like, according to whom?
Yeah. That is one of the strange things that I encountered in the course of talking to a lot of scientists about what time is in us, is that number one, there is no. It's not like that. We have a clock in our brain that is like the clock in a computer, and it it's sort of in one place. Whatever kind of timing device we have in there is really distributed pretty much across the entire brain. And number two, it's not a clock that, that kind of counts real time. Not in there saying, okay, this is a second, and then all the kind of weird bending time experiences you have are compared against that. No, it's, your experiences of time are... we'll probably have to circle around before this makes any sense, but it's really your brain listening to itself. There is no kind of fundamental baseline time, keeping device in there that tells you what is real and such that you know that everything else is, weird or not real.
Yeah, interesting. But time doesn't have to be associated with a clock. I mean, if you... bang your foot hard enough, this pipeline between your foot and your brain, these neural pathways, are such that they can get data that your foot was hit very quickly to your brain. So the neural pathway almost becomes the clock, because the larger the pipe, the I don't know, I'm having trouble describing it, but does that make any sense?
Well, you've touched on something, one of the many complexities about the brain. Yes, if you knock your foot against something, or even if you tap your foot, which is even more interesting, your foot, experiences something and it goes up the neuron into your brain and you feel it, right? But you're also seeing it. Mm. And the data travels more quickly, visually, speed of light being what it is. If you tap your foot, your arm probably isn't as long as your leg. So that's sending a signal into your brain too. And all those things, you touch your foot, that's now, right? But
right.
You've got three signals coming into your brain at different speeds. And imagine that you're a neuron in there and you've got these three streams of data and they are not coming to you instantaneously, because they arrive at different times. So How is it that your brain knows that those things belong together? How does it know, how does it know when now is? And the truth is it doesn't really, it takes a little time to figure that out. Time actually, now actually takes a little bit of time to define. And so it always kind of inevitably is expressed in your mind slightly after the fact.
And the sight of you banging your foot, you may pick that up quicker than the neural pathways. I'm thinking speed of light.
Or think about it this way. You know, if you see across the street somebody slams a car door, right? You see the door close, you hear their car door slam.
Then the sound
technically
comes.
You know, the sight and the sound are actually arriving at you with a bit of a delay, maybe a 60 millisecond delay, a 20th of a second. That's not an inconsiderable span of time, but your brain is going to just kind of decides, I'm going to make that seem simultaneously. I'm just going to erase that little span of time and serve that up to you as an instant. But if that same car door slams like 200 yards away, if the delay between the sight and the sound is more than about 80 milliseconds, your brain just says, oh, I'm going to give up right here. And you will experience the sight of the car door slamming before you hear the sound. You will experience the delay. There's kind of a cutoff point.
Wow. Now, you're kind of a rebel. I mean, for a while, I mean, I got a kick out of this because, I mean, this is the one piece of the book which I really liked was not only are you fascinated by the subject, but you're really kind of a rebel with time. You didn't wear a watch. You sort of push back against this, what might have been constructed artificially, and you started your search. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, well, yeah, you're being kind. As a friend of mine put it to me, you know, a person who doesn't wear a watch is a jerk. And you know, I started this project, 10 years ago or more, and I was coming from a place where I felt like, for a number of reasons, time is something that I didn't really want to have anything to do with, and I didn't want it to have anything to do with me. And I, you know, thought of time as this kind of social construct that gets kind of pressed down on us, and I just wasn't going to participate. And so I didn't wear a watch. As a consequence, I was often late, as my wife will tell you. She experienced that. Pardon me. She experienced that more than once. But, you know, as I dove into the subject of this book and really began to understand where time comes from in our minds and in our bodies and what it does for us in a positive way, I really began to see it as, you know, it's not some external thing that lands on us. It is a thing that we create, and we create it out of necessity because we really need it to be a social species. We need it not just to be able to say, okay, you know, we're going to talk at 3 o'clock in the afternoon, but, you know, just to be able to be sitting in the same room together and kind of sharing each other's vocal rhythms and kind of gestural rhythms and to kind of get the gist of this other person that you're talking to, that requires timing, and it requires some kind of a clock in your brain. And without that, it's really hard to be social. And so kind of at that point, I began to realize that, oh, yeah, like not wearing a watch and not dealing with time, it's not A, not only not realistic, but B, it is kind of antisocial. And plus, in that time, I became a parent. I started this book before my kids were born, and they're 10 now. And you know, you just gain a different feeling for what time needs to do for you and what your responsibility is to it.
If you're just joining us, our guest is Alan Burdick. He has written a book called Why Time Flies, a mostly scientific investigation. Burdick is a finalist for the National Book Award and a staff writer for The New Yorker. So it seems like, Alan, that perhaps in our culture we tend to write books on things that have escaped us. So self-help books, for example, you know, we'll talk about there is no past and there is no future. There's only the present, which makes me think that we never live in the present, right? Because we have to read books that tell us how to do it. And so I'm wondering how, you know, if we started talking about the concept of time 3,000 years ago, how was it different then that
how
you
was
found.
The experience different?
Yeah, or how did we talk about it differently?
I mean, I guess I would answer that in two ways. One, there's a degree to which we talked about it in very much the same way. I mean, you might think that, you know, now our lives are so full and we've got clocks all around us and our devices and we're just so busy and we're all kind of scraping to get enough time out of the day. But that was very much the same experience back then, too. And there's a great poem from Roman times of a guy basically complaining about a sundial and how he hates how it chops up his days and you know, kind of diminishes him by putting time right there in his face. So I kind of think that people have been complaining about time and the lack of it maybe ever since we've had something to talk about. But the other piece of it is, you know, back in the time of Plato and Aristotle, time was really discussed really just in terms of physics and trying to understand what time is and specifically like what right now is now instantaneous. Is it measurable? Does it have a length? If it has a length, can't you subdivide it into little smaller bits? And if it is made up of what's in between those bits? Does time pass in between there too? And the philosophers really kind of turn themselves into knots trying to figure all this out. And then Augustine comes along, and he's got a whole different agenda. And he basically says, look, we know, you know, past, present, future, three tenses, but the past doesn't really exist anymore, and the future doesn't really exist. All there is the present. And he says, actually, there are kind of three flavors of the present. There's our present experience of our memories, and there's our present experience of the future, which is expectation, mm-hmm. and then there is our present attention, and where we live is right there. And he describes the soul as being stretched out between memory and expectation. I love that image, and he says, you know, that is us, and we are intention. It's the tension of consciousness. He says, I would not be surprised if time is nothing more than the tension of consciousness. And what's interesting about that is he's basically defining now, as in, you know, this kind of now that bubbles up from moment to moment, as consciousness. Consciousness is now and the awareness of now. And so he's kind of moved, for one thing, he's moved time into the realm of psychology, but he's also kind of defined consciousness in terms of time, and that sticks. William James talks in very similar terms in the late 19th century, and I think it's really not far from the truth.
Yeah. So time for children, time for adults, how it relates to sleep and circadian rhythms. I mean, we know for children, time goes very slowly. The time it would take before to get you to Christmas was an eternity. So talk a little bit about that, would you? And how this all relates to circadian rhythms and some of the experiences that you have.
Yeah, so there are, there's kind of our perception of time and sort of the psychology of time. And that's very much, there are sort of different experiences that we have within that realm that we kind of lump under the category of time. But, you know, so for instance, a kid who's like 2 years old will speak, you know, really easily in the past tense and the present tense, but doesn't really understand the difference between before and after until they're like 4 years old. So you could ask Johnny in January, which is going to come first, Christmas or your birthday in July? And Johnny will say Christmas. Because he's looking backward and thinking, oh, yeah, that's the one that's closest to me. He's not thinking about, you know, direction. He's just thinking about proximity. So, you know, psychologically, our experience of time kind of comes online in stages. But meanwhile, underneath all of that, we are really born with these circadian rhythms, which are clocks really embedded in a genetic process that unfolds in the nucleus of our cells, that check out a really regular 24-hour rhythm and add it up, they really define our physiology. And, you know, so your liver is more, you know, it's got a clock, and it's more active during the day than it is at night, and so are your adrenal glands. So it means, like, you're worse at metabolizing alcohol at 10 o'clock at night, thanks to your liver. And those kinds, you know, those rhythms are just, you can't get around them, no matter what you do to your sleep cycle, no matter how many hours you stay awake or how many hours you sleep. That 24-hour cycle of kind of physiology is rock steady.
Boy, that's fascinating. And not all organs are lined up. I mean, there are so many things that are synchronous in some sort of rhythm, but as you mentioned, the liver, well, I think what you say is, like, if you're landing in New York and, you know, your liver's and you're coming from Europe, your liver may still be in Nova Scotia time and your pancreas may be something somewhere over Iceland.
And it takes
a few days for the digestive system to sort of figure stuff out.
Yeah, so, you know, so you have all these clocks. Each of your cells is a clock, and they add up to clocks called your liver and your bile ducts and your kidneys. And they don't all, you know, they have a maximum and a minimum over the course of the day, but they aren't all in the same phase. So it's kind of like a symphony. And, you know, the woodwinds come in over here, and then later the brass comes in. And they manage to all stay in the same, they manage to kind of keep time together thanks to a cluster of cells in the brain that acts as a conductor and, you know, kind of beats out its own 24-hour rhythm and really tells all those other clocks what time it is on a regular 24-hour basis. And meanwhile, that cluster of cells is getting input from outside, from the day. And so it's keeping all of those internal clocks in tune with a 24-hour day that, you know, when the sun rises and then the sun sets. But when you cross time zones, you really screw that up. So your brain will end up pretty quickly in the new place, but your liver is still catching up and your kidney is still catching up. And the impact of that, you know, especially for people who do a lot of night shift work, they're really living at a time of day that their circadian rhythm is not designed to support. And a lot of studies indicate that there are real health consequences, that diabetes and obesity and heart disease are much more prevalent in people who do a lot of night shift work.
And then there are cases outside of the actual organs or an actual individual where individuals line up, for an example, fireflies in the early part of the evening. They're all hammering away random and chaotically, flashing their lights. And over time, towards the end of the evening, some fireflies, groups of fireflies, will sync up and be a constant on or off. I haven't actually seen that, but I've heard about that. In Africa, there's a certain breed of fireflies. And then, you know, you hear about a child that is an infant, which is laying on your chest and you're taking a nap and you both come into the same breathing. It's almost like there's a relationship between time and self-organizing synchronicity.
There really is. And it's not so much in humans anyway related to circadian rhythms. It's really a function, believe it or not, of empathy. So a lot of studies show that when you're talking to somebody in person, interacting with them, the better that the two of you get along, the more likely you are to fall into rhythm in terms of your gestures and your facial expressions. You'll smile at the same time. You'll lift your coffee cup at the same time. You won't even notice that this is going on. But a third person who's watching can kind of judge, even unconsciously, how well the two of you get along by how much of this is happening. That is really born out of an ability to kind of pick up another person's rhythm, but also clearly a desire to almost put yourself in it and share it. So it's almost like we're kind of stepping in and out of each other's bodies and each other's sense of time, almost, in order to spend time together.
Our guest is Alan Burdick. His book is Why Time Flies, a mostly scientific investigation. Alan, share with us, if you will, the experiment that you witnessed about the sort of bending of time by just a slight portion, a tenth or so of a second, with the mouse, the computer mouse.
Oh, okay. So this was an experiment that was designed by David Eagleman, who's a neuroscientist now at Stanford. And he called it, for want of a better word, the nine square experiment. So picture a computer screen, and there are nine squares in a box, like a kind of a tic-tac-toe kind of thing. And one of them is lit up with a color. And my job, I'm sitting there doing the experiment, and I have a mouse in my hand, and I'm moving a cursor around the screen, and I click on, let's say the color is green, just for the sake of argument, I click on the green square. And the instant that I do, the green moves to a different square. So then I move my cursor over to that square, and I click, and instantly it moves to another square. And I do this, you know, for a while. Now, something is going on here that I'm not actually aware of, which is there's actually a delay in between when I click the mouse and when that square moves. It can be as little as, well, it can be instantaneous, but it can be as much of as a tenth of a second long, and my brain won't bother to tell me about it. It will seem to me that it is instantaneous. So the brain is kind of willing to lump things that I do with things that I see, as long as they fall within this like 100 millisecond tractor beam. But let's say I'm clicking along, and you know I click 100 millisecond. I don't notice it. Square moves. You know, again and again. Suddenly, Eagleman removes that 100 millisecond delay. What happens is, my brain is kind of expecting to serve up, 100 milliseconds equals zero, but suddenly it gets zero, and it serves me up with minus 100 milliseconds. So it's before, it seems to my brain, in reality, I am still clicking the clicking the square, and the square is moving. That is what is actually happening.
Yeah.
But my brain is telling me that what's happening is the square is moving slightly before I click it. It's moving before I tell it to. And it was really freaky. And I knew this was going to happen. Eagleman had told me about it, and I kind of expected it. And yet it still happened. And every time it happened, there was like just enough time for me to think, I could see the square move, and for me to think, okay, I'm not going to press the button. I'm not going to press the button this time. And I pressed the button.
<That's>
Because good. I had already pressed the button by the time I started thinking that I wouldn't do it.
That's time warp.
Alan, I was thinking about what you were saying before about a couple of people sit down, they're face to face, and they read each other's cadence, and they look at the physical cues, and they get lined up, and maybe they have a really good conversation for all sorts of reasons that they may not know. And I was just thinking about that, and it always boggled me that, it's so expensive to fly somewhere, and it's such a hassle getting to the airport, and it can be expensive, takes a lot of time and everything. Why hasn't teleconferencing really taken off the way people have promised it? And there's been four generations of teleconferencing right now. And right now they have this thing called telepresence where the technology is such that the delay has been minimized so you can you really feel like you're in a room with someone. Do you think that that has something to do with why teleconferencing has not been successful?
It's interesting that you should say that. I hadn't really thought about that, but I wouldn't be surprised if that's true. And it's funny because I recently started working from time to time in an office, and occasionally I would teleconference in for a group meeting, and I just never found it to be as satisfying an experience. And I think it really is in part because, maybe it's different if it's a one-on-one thing and you've got a big face, right there looking at you. But certainly I found when I'm kind of dealing with a group of people and they're all looking at each other, they're kind of picking up each other's cues, and I can't really see all of that directly.
Right.
I do think that I am missing out something, and I wouldn't even know as it's happening exactly, I wouldn't be able to put my finger on it, but it just feels, it's just not as satisfying, and I don't feel like I really kind of learn as much or bond as well as I do when I'm right there.
I feel the same way. I mean, otherwise we wouldn't have planes except for travel and recreation. I mean, there's so much business travel that takes place. And it's so painful to travel today. You would think that teleconferencing would be bigger. But anyway,
yeah,
interesting.
Now, but the funny thing is that doesn't seem to really bother us over the phone.
Yeah.
No, it
turns out actually, you can hear a smile. You can hear you can hear when somebody smiles even without seeing it. You know it.
Yeah,
that is kind of a matter of timing and of rhythm and being able to pick up that cadence.
You know, we've been having phone conversations for so long, ever since you were like 3 or 4 years old talking to grandma, and we've learned that in these conversations that there will be no visual cues, and maybe that has something to do with it.
Yeah, and it's true for both parties.
Yeah.
So there's no. You know, there's no expectation at the other end.
Yeah. Well, Alan, time has flown for the last half hour, and we've run out of it now. But it's such a fascinating book, and things that it makes me think about, that's the thing. It's like it spurs your creative mind to go off in all kinds of wild directions. So I love that about this book. The book is Why Time Flies, A Mostly Scientific Investigation. Our guest is Alan Burdicht. And Alan, thanks so much for joining us on Cool Science Radio.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Alan.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Again, Alan Burdicht and Why Time Flies. Love that conversation. We'll be right back after these words. Stay with us.
Spend the day and cover billions of years at the Natural History Museum of Utah. The museum offers innovative exhibits and hands-on experiences. Native voices explore the traditions of Utah's native peoples. The Great Salt Lake Gallery tells the story of the largest saltwater lake in the Western Hemisphere. The Past Worlds exhibit includes more than a dozen new species of dinosaurs discovered right here in Utah. Visit nhmu.utah.edu. The Natural History Museum of Utah is a nonprofit organization and a KPCW supporter.
This is Courtney Johansson with the Spur Bar and Grill, and we are proud to support KPCW. With our new 352 Main Street entrance, the Spur now features 3 bars serving breakfast, lunch, dinner, drinks, and dancing. Open 7 days a week from 10 a.m. to 1 a.m. with live music every night. More information at thespurbarandgrill.com.
Thanks for tuning in to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware Peek, here with John Wells. I want to thank our underwriters, the Natural History Museum of Utah, San Francisco Design, Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties, Peak Art and Frame, Nexus IT, Park City Mountain, and Davidson Orthopedics. And want to thank our wonderful guests today, Alan Burdicht with Why Time Flies, and also McKay Jenkins, the author of Food Fight, GMOs and the Future of the American Diet.
I enjoyed both books.
Absolutely.
Yeah. You know, Jenkins said in his book that there are 26 countries with a total or a partial ban on GMO products. And I thought that was interesting.
Yeah, most of Europe.
Mm-hmm.
Even you mentioned China.
China doesn't have a full ban on it, but I think they have a partial ban, a pretty significant ban on GMOs. So it's interesting. And, I wonder why Europe's always ahead of us in these things.
Yeah. Well, it's about recognizing the value in what we ought to, good, whole food.
Yeah. Not as many lobbyists, not as much influence. Interesting.
That's right. You're listening to KPCW Park City. It's time now for national news.